Hello and welcome to the Inner Zone podcast with me, Mike Ryder.
And me, Josh Hughes.
In this episode, we're going to talk about the academic jobs market and job hunting in general, as this is something both Josh and I have been embroiled in recently, I think it's fair to say. So we thought we'd share our trials and tribulations with you and see if we can come up with any answers.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably worth starting with, you know, a while ago someone told me the fact that for every academic job that's out there, at least 60 people apply for it.
60?
60 at least.
Is that just on a national level?
Well, it's average, obviously.
Right.
Yeah, I think on a national level in the UK.
Wow, that's quite something, really.
So it kind of puts it into perspective as to how competitive it is.
Have you got any idea on the breadth of sort of experience levels applying for that same post? So say it's just a normal lectureship. Yeah. Is it going to be more senior people as well as less qualified people? Is it?
Well, I think it depends, because I think, you know, a starting lectureship is obviously kind of intended. It's a job role that's not maybe intended, but it's ideal. Somebody who's just finished their PhD, got an article or two, and, you know, has got a bit of teaching experience. That's what, you know, an entry level lectureship is supposed to, is ideal for that, isn't it?
Well, that's what we're told an entry level position is supposed to be.
But then, if you apply for those jobs like we've been doing, and but actually you're not only competing against people who are in a similar situation to you, you're also competing against people who have maybe been out of academia for a couple of years doing a job to pay the bills, but doing writing journal articles on the side. You know, they've got a much better research track record. You know, they've probably planned modules and seminars and lectures and stuff. So it's quite difficult to be the person who the job is ideal for and in the position where you should be able to get this job, but there's lots of other people who have been in that position, you know, 2 years ago or a year ago, and have been you know, preparing for it better, basically.
And it's especially hard at the better universities as well.
Yeah, because that's where everyone wants to go, isn't it?
Yeah, and often you'll find their pay scales are better.
Well, I don't know, actually. I think most of them seem to be about the same.
I suppose maybe it varies by department, perhaps, as well.
But I suppose as well it seems that universities that maybe a bit lower down the rankings seem to have lots of options for like being a lecturing pro rata. So you just take a module when it's available, and because the department can give it to you. Whereas it seems that universities that are a bit higher up the scale are often more, you know, you're going to be assigned certain modules to teach for the length, for however long you're there, basically, pretty much, unless you take a sabbatical.
We should probably at this point just lay out the different types of job roles available, because it's not just lectureships, because obviously you and I are both ideally looking for lectureships, which is a balance of teaching and research.
And administration.
And administration, our favourite thing. But there's also, you've got these teaching-only contracts, and you've got these research-only contracts.
Yeah.
The thing with a teaching-only contract is that, yes, you do more teaching, but you don't accrue leave time for research in doing that.
Most of the time, yeah.
Which means it's quite hard if you're getting onto a teaching-only contract to then move to a normal lectureship, because the assumption is with a normal lectureship, you'll have more research behind you. So once you're in a teaching-only role, you sort of get stuck in a cycle, really, of just being, therefore, suited to more teaching, further teaching based roles, because any research you want to do has to be done in your own time outside of work.
Yeah, so it's like this uber specialisation, isn't it? Not only have you specialised in your subject and your subject area, you've specialised in teaching it rather than anything else.
Yeah, despite the fact you've got a research degree.
Yeah, and a probably quite a good researcher. I mean, you don't get a PhD if you're not a good researcher.
No.
Most of the time. I think in a way, it gives opportunities to people who really like teaching and really only want to do teaching, because there are some people out there who teaching in a university is what they want to do.
Yeah.
They're not actually that bothered. Maybe they like research for their own interest, but they don't really like the faff of writing journal articles, because it is a faff, isn't it?
Yeah, big faff.
And so you find some people who like to do the research for their own interest or to improve their teaching. So I can talk about that in this seminar, I can talk about that. But don't actually want to do the journal article. So you do find these people who specialise in teaching and enjoy it, and that's what they want to do. And I suppose now, or in the past couple of years, you sort of seem to be see people who are becoming professors of teaching, which was previously impossible because you needed both the teaching and the research track record to be a professor.
Right, really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So there's a few places that are allowing people to be professors in teaching, because it was for years it's been people who are research professors.
Yeah.
So it seems a bit strange to only allow, if you're going to have a specialism at professor level, to be the only research.
Mm.
Why not teaching? I suppose at least links to the history that a professor was somebody who supervised, you know, super high level research as well.
Yeah, I suppose maybe the sort of definition of the role is changing in a way, because in a way now professorship is just a sort of mark of seniority as much as anything else.
Well, yeah, it seems that everyone who's not yet a professor is like, I really want to be it, or sees it as the kind of the goal.
Mm.
A lot of people who are professors are just like, it's just a job title.
But it's also a temporary job title, because as soon as you leave that job role, you're no longer a professor.
Yeah.
It's just a role associated with your employment.
Yeah. I mean, my favourite story about getting to professor level was a sociologist here at Lancaster who said, it's just a job title, it might as well be janitor. I was like, that's great. But then you think, well, you've got the experience of being a professor in order to be self-deprecating about it, whereas everyone is not.
And you have the pay packet of a professor to be self-deprecating about it. Yeah, because while they may put themselves down, I mean, they get paid a lot more and you get a lot more respect from your peers for that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I remember speaking to somebody who said when they used to get flights to conferences or meetings or whatever, organised by the university, would always put their official title on. Mm. So for however many years, it was Doctor this. And whenever they got on a plane, the only sort of special thing that would happen is somebody would say, are you a medical doctor? And they'd say, no, I'm, you know, sociologist or whatever. And then when it became professor, suddenly they were being offered upgrades to first class.
Wow, there we go. That's the goal, see, yeah. Because there's another question that arises here, I suppose, in terms of how people then see us in the profession. I'm quite interested by the fact that a lot of my students, especially international students, they don't really see a distinction between professor and doctor, because the word professor is used to refer to anyone in a sort of a position such as ours. So instead of being called an associate lecturer, you'd be called associate professor. So professor is just another sort of term of referring to an academic who is in a...
Well, yeah, so in different places, it's sort of the ranks are given different titles, aren't they?
Mm.
So instead of lecturer, senior lecturer, professor, it would be assistant professor, associate professor, full professor, and then maybe a distinguished professor.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think in some places, it's you sort of... Yeah, I think you're definitely right. Some students do approach whoever's teaching them as equals, and then, you know, you go back to your office and you think, I'm nothing compared to the guy next door or the woman next door.
But, I mean, there's a lot of posturing in academia, isn't there?
Yeah, there is.
Especially if you look at people's email signatures, I find. I find this is a pet hate of mine anyway, in any form of work where anyone decides they're going to put any sort of academic qualification after their name or sort of job title or things like that, because I find it is sort of... Especially if it's like, oh, well, BA ons. Well, you're like, okay, yeah, everyone here's got a BA ons, haven't they? But you do find, say, people will say, I'm director of this program, when in reality all they're doing is a couple of hours a week part-time, just doing the admin for a certain course.
That's what it depends, doesn't it? Because some people who are directors of programmes, that's their entire job, pretty much.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and there's some people who don't really do very much with that title. But I suppose, I don't know. It doesn't really bother me.
Oh, it does me, only because I've worked sort of outside of academia before, and I just, when I see people sort of posturing with their positions or sort of trying to make their position out to be better than it is, dare I say?
Yeah, I suppose it's a bit unusual when you see people listing undergraduate degrees or even master's degrees in comparison to people who have got, you know, I guess you put it onto, do you put it onto show off, I think? Or do you think it's just saying like, oh, actually, I'm not stupid?
I don't know, it's a difficult one. In the world of normal work, I call everything outside of academia normal work, because academia is a weird special case.
Mm.
I've encountered people that have put just a BA, for example, after their name. And to me, I find that slightly I don't know, slightly offensive because it does feel like they're trying to show off, or they're trying to sort of show, it shows they're a little bit insecure, I feel. I know it's just a slight tangent. But you're right, but it is very hard to tell, for example, between what you mean when you say director of this, director of that. Because technically, I suppose you could say we are co-directors of the In The Zone podcast, which would look lovely under our email signatures. But it's only really relevant to a certain number of people.
Mm. Yeah. So I suppose in that way, it's only problematic to put a fancy title after your email signature if you're not interested in what it's about. I mean, if you need to find the director of such and such a research program, it's great if someone's got it on the email signature.
Yeah, and I suppose you should differentiate as well between internal and external communications. I mean, if you're making a research bid, yeah, sure, put it all in. But if I'm just emailing you, you might not need to, for example.
But I suppose it does look good on the CV.
And calling yourself director of something.
Well, yeah. But I suppose if this podcast is about job hunting, it's all about getting a good CV.
Yeah, I suppose. But again, there's a balance to be had between selling yourself and misrepresenting yourself. And this is something I found a lot in sort of the real world outside of academia, where people will deliberately, or maybe sometimes not deliberately, but they'll misrepresent the sort of their seniority or the sort of the management they've had, their management experience, for example, that they've had. Think very much it's a bit like The Apprentice, but these things happen in real life. You're like, I can't believe this. I can't believe people apply with claiming the things that they claim. And then you sort of dig below the surface a little bit and you find out that actually they're not quite what they say.
Yeah, but I think having looked at quite a lot of job adverts and job descriptions inside and outside academia, I've noticed that within academia, they're often very specific.
Mm.
Like, if you look at job applications, so most job applications I've been looking at are like lecturer, well, we'll say most places it's grade 7 or grade 8 is the job advert will go for. And sort of a grade 7 is like entry-level lecturer, and grade 7 is a slightly more senior one. And often the difference, or one of the major differences, will be supervising research students, so PhD students, masters, research students. So obviously that's very specific. Whereas in job adverts outside academia, it'll be like management experience.
Yeah.
And that'll be it. And it's like, well, I've got some management experience. I've done, I've managed this and that. But, is that what they're looking for? Some occasional bits, or are they looking for someone who's managed multi-million pound projects and however many staff?
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? So there's grey areas in job adverts in the real world are often quite confusing, I think. And unless there's some sort of unsaid language about it that is difficult to understand unless you're sort of a HR person.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I would say there's also grey areas in the academic sense, in the sense that both of us will know people who have had issues with their supervisors, or they might be allocated a team of maybe two or three supervisors, and one of those supervisors they'll never see. And then what happens is that supervisor will have put you down as an example of their research supervision, when really they didn't do any research supervision. They just happened to be sort of an administrator on the list, sort of as an administrative sort of tick box thing.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think it depends, because lots of supervisory teams are often split according to a sort of percentage of level of supervision, aren't they?
Mm.
So you might have some person who's 50 or 60%, another person who's 30%, and then if a junior colleague might then come on as a 10%er.
Yeah,
I suppose they don't really do very much, because there is that. It is only 10%, but I suppose if they read your work a couple of times a semester.
But for their own job hunting prospects,
oh, right,
they'd still be able to claim, yeah, I've supervised X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
Which, so I'm just sort of trying to put it out there, really, that I think there is also this element. This is probably why you see all this quite a lot in academia, where you get sort of loads of supervisors on a project, maybe. Or
I wonder, because there's also the tension within the department that they need to bring up junior staff to be able to do supervisions.
Mm.
So actually they need to feed them a PhD student to train on, basically, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, the whole idea of training is quite a contentious one, I think, especially for early career researchers like ourselves, because there's a thing in academic job hunting where you need to have a certain amount of teaching experience, you need to have a certain amount of experience doing X, Y, Z, but to get that, you need to be in the job to be able to do it. So when you don't have the job or your department doesn't offer you any, well, how do you get that experience? There's no real way to. And this just ties in with the whole precarity thing and not being able to get a full-time contract.
Yeah, the precarity of early career research life seems to just be an absolutely horrendous thing that a lot of people are going through. And I suppose in a way we're kind of shielded from it because we're just finishing our PhD, so we're not kind of fully in the lion's mouth, as it were. Soon it might be fully in there. But you know, you see sort of people who are, you know, their friends have allowed them to become sort of an honorary research fellow so that they can have access to a library resources. Because otherwise they're classed as an independent researcher who has, you know, nothing but open access journals and Google books and or things they've managed to, or, you know, textbooks they've managed to pirate off the internet, basically. So it must, because I think, you know, I think sometimes I think about academic precarity and how people maybe do whatever it is, you know, a year or 2 years of research fellow contracts and this and that and work on certain projects and think, well, that's really hard to move around the country, probably for, maybe it might be all right money, it might not be, you never know. You know, to only be there somewhere for a year or two and then lose access to all the resources at university and then try and do the same job. Do research at the same level must be really hard.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is something that I'm finding myself at the moment where my housing contract here was coming to an end. My PhD is basically an end. And I'm at a point where actually I need to get a job. But at what point do I make a firm decision to move to any part of the country I need to if I can get a job? Or how? At what point do I then say, no, I'm going to have to stay here because I've got a few hours potentially on offer? So then I move house, I move into a new place, which obviously costs a lot of money to move and whatnot. And then that signs me up to a sort of spiral of debt, really. And then I've got maybe sort of 4 or 5 hours teaching a week on campus next year. Then I've got to top that up with part-time jobs around that and or anything else I can get my hands on. But it's very hard to get your hands on things, because especially in this sort of, it's a very tough market out there. And obviously university hasn't got very much money because it's spending it all on building projects.
Yeah, it seems, because I think Lancaster has been in a bit of a strange position for the past few years in that it seems to have a lot of money for building and doesn't seem to have much money for staff. But yeah, it's, I suppose it's another thing about being in a academic precarious position is that if you top up your money with sort of part-time work, you know, a lot of part-time jobs, it's not like it used to be where you can sort of turn up and you do a bit and you know, you go home. It's sort of, you turn up and in quite a lot of places you're expected to work quite hard for quite long hours, even if it's not full time. And so to often be quite drained from that.
Yeah.
To then go home and think, oh, now I need to try and write this keep writing this article so that it looked better on my academic CV, so hopefully I can get a job next year.
Yeah, and I mean, the whole process of writing papers, writing publications, if you're not employed in a full-time position, is very difficult for an early career researcher. I mean, I've got this at the moment, so I've got a few weeks free whilst moving house, but every morning I get up and it's like I know that I've got to sit down and spend the day working on XYZ papers. I've said XYZ quite a few times this podcast, but I've got to work on all these papers that I've got ideas for, which is essentially, inverted commas, free work that I'm doing in the hope that it might get published in a year's time, in the hope that I might then be able to add it to my CV, and in the hope that someone then might see that and that might add to my chances of getting a job in the future. But I'm basically speculating to accumulate, but in doing that, I'm giving up the time that I could be spending earning money now.
Yeah. Because obviously I think probably people outside academia think, oh, you write an article and, you know, you're smart, so it must be pretty easy. But of course it isn't.
No.
It's, you know, although there are some rubbish, if the thing is, if you write a rubbish article that you just dash off in, well, even if you write a rubbish article that you just kind of dash off, it's still a few days worth of work.
And the rest, and then work further down the line.
Yeah, and for it to then, because it's not that good, it goes into a rubbish journal, so no one respects it, so it doesn't really mean anything on your CV.
No.
Whereas if you try and get into a good journal, then it takes, you know, months of work, really, full time, pretty much, to, you know, and then to be at the mercy of a reviewer who might just say no.
Yeah. A reviewer who themselves might not be in the best position to be able to judge it.
Well, yeah. So I suppose it kind of, it links back to the strange economic model of academia, in that the research in academia is essentially given away for free to journals who then sell it.
Then sell it and make money out of it.
Yeah.
While I'm being paid for, say, 4 hours of teaching a week, 5 hours of teaching a week, while doing the rest of my work for free, and I hope I might get a job further down the line.
Mm. It's, I mean, this is a classic thing, isn't it? That people outside academia can't even believe that this is the publishing model within academia even works or is even allowed to continue.
Yeah, and then you think about this whole idea that the things that we publish might not really be read either.
That's another thing, isn't it? It's the constant worry of academics is that they're just shouting into the void and no one's listening and no one cares.
Well, even more so in the humanities, I'd say, because, I mean, at least in the sciences, I think you've got this element where you're feeding into a body of knowledge that has some sort of practical application here and now. And then with this sort of lack of arts and humanities research funding, like the lack of appreciation for the arts, really, and with the focus on STEM subjects these last few years, I feel the pressure in that area is even stronger. I mean, you're in a weird area, because I feel like law sort of straddles the two, because I think people take it a lot more seriously than, say, dare I say, English literature.
Yeah, I think so. But I think so. I think it's kind of, because it's, I think law is, for many years, it's been sort of almost a vocational subject.
Mm.
You go to a law school and you learn how to be a lawyer, and then you go and be a lawyer. Whereas in the past few years, it's kind of, well, I suppose for a long time, it's been, actually, there is sort of a seam of treating it as an academic subject. You don't, you know, some people don't study law to be a lawyer, they study law because it's interesting, in the same way that people study history because it's interesting, or philosophy or whatever. I think that's been around for a long time, but in the past sort of few years, it seems like it's become a much bigger thing for people to study it as an academic, you know, area of academic inquiry.
Yeah.
But it's still, I think people do, but I don't think people realise that either. Because I've been to plenty of conferences, sort of general interest conferences. So I said, oh, I study international law. And sort of look at me like, why are you here?
Yeah.
As though, what could you possibly have to tell us?
And the thing is, I get this from another angle, because I say, I do English literature. And people look at me and think, what are you doing here? What do you have to tell us?
Well, of course, you don't really do English literature, do you?
No,
you,
I don't.
You do philosophy through.
Yeah, I know, but the thing is, I get this sort of sense. I feel like, oh, well, it doesn't mean anything, does it, really? Yeah. It's because technically on my certificate it will say English literature. Obviously, yeah, I do lots of other things, and I like to describe myself as interdisciplinary. But even just like the subject you do says a lot about you. I feel that there are unspoken codes, I think, that people assign to certain subjects.
Well, yeah, I think you kind of... you can sometimes see it at conferences, the people who are quite... callous and just want to get ahead. If you're in a circle of people who've probably just met that the morning and they're sort of chatting about what your research's interests are, and someone comes along and someone says, "Oh, I'm from a humanities subject," some people occasionally you will see they'll just turn around and walk away because you're a humanities subject, so you can't add anything to me. You can't do me anything, which is strange because I think something that we see now, particularly when it comes to technology companies, is actually there's a dire need for people who study the humanities to come and say, you know, you're with tech companies, your technologies are having this effect on society, or, you know, it's having this impact on this section of society, and this is what you need to do, and this is what's going wrong, this is what you need to do, this is how you should do it. And there's that dearth of realisation, I think, because obviously most people in tech companies are really engineers. Think, oh, well, it's just an engineering problem to solve. Actually, no, it's not. Say you think about the ethics of AI or the ethics of Google. That's not an ethics problem to solve, because there's, what can you do to it other than make it worse?
Yeah.
So it's a more qualitative problem to solve, and so you need people from the humanities to say, this is unethical, this is what you should do, or maybe if we do this, or maybe if we do that. So I suppose there should, but it seems like the call for that kind of job role has not really permeated as far as it should.
No, and I feel personally within these humanities subjects, I don't feel like the people in the subjects necessarily see this as a direction of travel for the subjects. I mean, English literature will still study Shakespeare. I mean, undergraduates will still study all the old things that you expect people to study doing English literature. And there's this, I think you get this feeling that, well, something's got to give at some point because we've got to sort of bring ourselves into the 21st century, especially when I think about English literature. Because, I mean, I'm very keen when I came to university of thinking about, well, the big so what. The big so what question, and this is why I write quite a lot for The Conversation. I do all these blogs and things because I'm very keen on trying to make the things that I do have some sort of real world impact or show the implications of what I do, and not just write about sci-fi books for a living, which is kind of what I do without earning a living, part of it. But there, I think there is that need. I think academia in general does need to evolve a bit, especially the classical subjects. I think
I mean, I've been wondering recently about whether I think again law is quite a unique subject in that there are core modules that have to be taught at every law school, whereas in other departments or other subject areas, you know, lecturers kind of come up and say, this is what I studied, this is what I'm going to teach, and then, you know, if you get the job, that's what you teach, apart from, you know, 101 sort of courses and basics and that. So I sort of wonder whether, you know, If you turn up and say, I do postmodernism looking at film or something or whatever, and then, well, that's what you do, and then maybe that's all you can do, and so in 20, 30 years you're behind the times, and so in a way it constantly needs sort of refreshing and new people coming in who are doing forward thinking things. But I suppose if you study in a department that has people who are behind the times, then it's difficult for you to be, you know, out in front, isn't it? Because you've never sort of had anybody to say, this is the future, this is what's coming, this is what we need to think about.
And this is, I think this is a problem with academia in general, in that a lot of it does tend to be conservative with a small c, despite the fact it's incredibly left-wing, most of academia, really. It is conservative with a small c insofar as it's very sort of reticent to change, I think, in certain areas. And often you've got this case where people have been in jobs for a very long time and they're quite comfortable in jobs because obviously each year they get their sort of incremental pay increase. And there's no, when they came into their jobs, there were no key performance indicators, there were no targets and things. So they're sort of safe in their jobs.
Yeah, I suppose that's the classic thing, isn't it? That when people think about academics, they think about Oxford dons who sat in a senior common room and smoked a pipe and read the newspaper and then sent their PhD student off to teach everything they did, and then barely did any work. But of course, it's not like that now at all. It's
Not for the younger ones, anyway.
There's all these performance indicators that you have to be able to, you know, make certain achievements, and you have to be able to show the potential of that on your job application. You know, on your CV, you have to be able to say, well, I could, you know, I'm going to do this research, which would contribute to your, you know, REF submission, research excellence framework.
Yeah.
You know, I've done this great research, so, you know, it's 3 or 4 star or whatever it is. So you should hire me because I can contribute to, yeah, to that submission, which then means the university can get mucked and charge more for degrees.
Yeah.
And, you know, the same with the, well, not quite the same, but probably will be the same soon with the teaching excellence framework and potentially even the knowledge exchange framework that's coming as well.
It's madness. I mean, how are people in our position supposed to get on the ladder when you're competing against people who have been in the system for a long time, have got the boxes ticked, as it were, and there's no scope for us to be able to get the experience that we need to get onto that ladder?
Yeah, it's, I mean, I've sort of spoken to somebody else about this a little while ago, and I think it's particularly in academia, it seems to be the case, but also outside of academia, in that lots of people are advertising for jobs, and when you read the job description, it seems like actually what they want is someone who's done the job for 5 years, you know, because they want somebody with all the experience and all of the ability to just turn up and do it on day one, when actually you're advertising an entry-level position. So you should be more appreciative of the fact that this is people who are going to come in are actually inexperienced. They have potential and they can turn up and they do it, but actually it's not like, yeah, it's not going to be the same as someone who can turn up and do it with 5 years experience. And I think that's, again, it links, probably links back to, you know, people who've been out of academia for a couple of years and then come back to it, you know, having tried to come back to it all the time.
Mm.
It seems like, you know, if you go to an interview and you do really well and someone says, oh, you've done really well for your, you know, your level of experience, but then you get sniped out of it by someone who's, you know, got more experience but you're going for the same job.
Yeah, or they've already got the applicant in mind,
yeah,
that they want, and they're just sort of ticking the boxes and by holding the interviews in the first place.
That seems to happen in some places, doesn't it?
It happens a lot in the private sector.
Yeah. Well, I suppose that's another thing. Having read a few blogs about moving out of academia,
yeah,
which seems to be the people who blog about it seems to treat it as this enormous thing, getting a job outside of academia, like you have to transition. Well, no, you get a job and you go and do it.
You just get a job and go do it. Yeah, I mean, for them, maybe because they've never had a job outside, and they've never been outside academia, but for most people, it's just getting a job.
Yeah, but I think one of the things that's quite surprising to people who do move out of academia is, so I read one of the blogs that Emily Lynn, or one of our previous guests, recommended. I can't remember what the lady who wrote it was called, but she sort of said, you know, 70% of jobs aren't even advertised, so you have to try and get into the position where you can hear about those jobs.
Mm.
Which I suppose is a bit different, because in academia pretty much everything's advertised, even if they've got somebody in mind.
Well, for big organisations there are rules and governance that sort of manage these sort of things. I don't know where she got those figures from. I'd be interested to know.
Well, I thought it seemed quite
large,
but even if it's not that number, is, you know, a key part of getting a decent job is being able to being plugged into those networks where you can hear about them.
Mm. And knowing about the right people at the right time. I mean, there could be the perfect job come up for me the other side of the country, but if I don't have access to those networks or I don't know about it, then how can I apply?
Exactly, yeah.
And I'm busy, I'm looking at millions of things, I'm writing articles for free.
Yeah.
As we all are.
I suppose that's part of it, isn't it? Is that you might hear about a job, and, you know, I suppose we're quite fortunate in that senior academic colleagues who think you're good, you know, would be good at an academic job, will sometimes send you job adverts and say you should apply for this. I wish that's really rewarding, that someone thinks you're good enough for the job and thinks you should do it. But I suppose if you're, but again, it's being plugged into the network, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you're not plugged into it, then you're kind of just, you're looking at the same thing as everybody else is, and you're not being told about any opportunities. So you're kind of disadvantaged, aren't you?
So knowing the right people, being in the right place at the right time, that's sort of the answer that we've sort of come to when it comes to getting into the academic job market.
Well, I suppose it can't just be that kind of, there's obviously this ability, it's obviously the major thing.
Yeah, but it's hard, isn't it?
It is hard, because I suppose the thing is that everyone who is doing a PhD and close to the end of a PhD has basically spent most of their life being a high achiever, and then to have to then compete with other high achievers, it's quite difficult, because you've basically been the winner. I suppose you've basically spent most of your life being a big fish in some regard, and then to be put into the bigger pond.
I guess so, and this is why it is important to do as much as you can to stand out.
Yeah.
But sometimes I get those feelings some days. I think when I've just been working hard and I'm like, why am I doing this? When you think, well, what is the point? Because you think, well, I do all this stuff that no one else in my department does, but is it getting me anywhere? No, because I'm skint. I still haven't got any furniture in my house. I'm eating my dinner on the floor. But every morning I'm up at 6 o'clock typing away in the hope that someone somewhere might give me a job one day.
Yeah. I suppose it's everyone's fighting for the golden ticket, aren't they?
Yes, I think they are, and I think that's definitely what we're doing, but hopefully...
Hopefully we'll be successful.
Yeah, if you're listening to this podcast and you want to give Josh or myself a job, that would be great. Please do get in contact with us, and I think that's a good place to bring this episode to an end. Thank you for listening to the In The Zone podcast with Mike Ryder and Josh Hughes.
For more podcasts and interesting chat, visit InTheZonePodcast.com.